The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It is now my great pleasure to introduce James McBride. You might think it's my great pleasure because I just got to spend a few minutes with a guy who is very serious when he writes books. He writes bestsellers that are on the New York Times forever, and if not, they get the National Book Award. You might think I was thrilled to be with somebody who writes songs for Anita Baker, Grover Washington Jr., and Barney. True fact. You can look that up. It's on the interweb. Or you might think I was happy to be with a guy who wrote a really good musical theater, Bobos, which is actually about sneakers, in case you're wondering, which is a great show. But really, I'm thrilled because 30 years ago, when James lived across the street from me on Pine Street, never thought that both of us would be here. I'm just so delighted that we could. But I had a library card at the time. That was the sense that I might wind up at the library. But there were hints that James had greatness in him, and he wound up at the library for different reasons. And I can tell you a couple things that are not on the internet, which you might be interested in. I hope he's not listening. And I will not tell you, also because my lovely wife is here, we were two guys in our 20s. I won't tell you what we were doing, like on Saturday night and stuff like that. But there's a great story. But James was actually busy after an award-winning career in journalism as a student and playing saxophone for a while. He was busy doing research on, I think, what turned out to be The Color of Water. And he was committed to it, so committed to it that in his studio apartment, which contained a mattress, no box spring, no chairs, a little stove, and a typewriter, it also had an answering machine. So sometimes we'd be in there talking. And I remember once Jan Wenner, who was the editor of Rolling Stone, called him up and was like pleading with him to write this cover story on some singer that nobody ever heard of at the time. It was Whitney Houston. And James was like, he's too busy for this, and he's working on this thing, it's so important. When it came out and he saw what Whitney Houston looked like, he actually regretted his choice. But we all make mistakes. James has gone on for those of you, I'm sure many people here know him. And as I've seen James through his career, he's still stayed James. All the fame really has not got to him, and I can't think of a more grounded guy to write a biography. So with that, we'll turn over the stage to him to talk about his biography of James Brown, Kill 'Em and Leave. James McBride.
I could always count on John Seltzer to just reveal everything. But it's great to see him here. He's a very, very skilled surgeon and very skilled man of medicine. So if you need a heart operation, you can get the James McBride discount from him, which means that you probably will be paying double. But anyway, it's so nice to see so many nice people here today. to talk about James Brown. It's nice to be back in Philly. It's always great to come back to Philly. Philly is kind of home for me. I lived here for a long time. My mother lived here and lived in Germantown. My sister still lives here. I have two sisters who live here, actually. One up in Germantown and one downtown. And a niece. I have a lot of family here in Philly. My family was coming to Philly from New York long before these New Yorkers were showing up. So we get Philly credit. You get Philly credit for coming here in the 70s, when Philly was truly funky. And as the funk has left Philly, it has become less interesting. But it's still a great city, and this is a great library. And I'm here all the time. I slip in and out of this library all the time. I do a lot of my research here. Very grateful for this library. It's interesting because at the NYU, where I teach once a week, if you want to get a book out, you got to go, and then they say, well, you got to go to this library uptown because you can't take it out. But at this library, they say, dong, take it. Just take it out, and you better bring it back. I'd like to acknowledge that Elliot Shellcroft was a a good friend of this library and a good friend of mine, and Oberlin graduate, happy to say, fellow OB, him and his, I think his wife as well, or one of his wives, whatever. He was a good friend of mine for a long time, and I was very sorry to see him leave this life, but the point of being alive is to live and live well so that the people come behind you will live as well. And that's part of the reason why I wrote this book about James Brown, other than the fact that I was divorced and needed the money badly. But what happened was, well, let me just back up. When I was at Oberlin, I was studying. There was, before Oberlin had its magnificent jazz department, there was only one guy who taught jazz in the conservatory. His name was Wendell Logan. He was a black guy. If you wanted to learn jazz saxophone, you went to Wendell Logan. If you wanted to learn jazz trombone, that would be Wendell. Jazz arranging, jazz piano, Wendell was the guy you went to see. He was a black guy from Mississippi who grown up in the South in the Civil Rights Movement. He went to Florida A&M, and he was a classmate of Cannonball Adderley. He was a wonderful composer and a deeply gifted teacher and a very demanding teacher. So he had a jazz arranging course that he taught. His high level course was jazz arranging, and me and my best friend Leander Bean, who was Alec Bean's brother, Alec and John are best friends. Leander was a classical pianist, was and is a classical pianist from New Hampshire. And he didn't play jazz, but we took this course together because Leander loved jazz and he wanted to learn jazz arranging. So at the midterm, we had to write this arrangement where you set something up for like three or four horns and the students play it, and then afterwards, Wendell would take your score and he would grade it, and that was your midterm grade. So Leander got a... he got an A, and I got my paper back, and I got a C. So after class, I waited till the class emptied, and everybody, I waited till Leander left, and then I went up to Wendell, and I said, Professor Logan, I said, Leander got an A on his midterm, and like, I got a C, and, he's kind of, and he looked at me like, and he said something to me that I'll never forget. He said, I gave Leander an A because he deserved it. And I gave you a C because you deserve it. And you just got a D now. He said, don't ever come in here and talk to me like that. He said, this music is about the truth. And if you're not about the truth, you're not qualified to play any kind of music. Now, good afternoon. And, of course, I was really embarrassed and, you know. And I ate it, you know. And so that's who this book is dedicated to. At the very beginning of the book, it says just that. If you are not about the truth, you're not qualified to play any kind of music. So I can talk about the origins of why I'm doing it, why I did this book, but I thought it would be better if I just read for about 6 hours and, you know. No, that's my sister there. That's it. No, I'll read a little bit and then talk about the subject of this very, very what I hope is a compelling book. And it's not a biography, actually. It's a book about James Brown and how his life is a metaphor for what's going on in our country, both in the past and now. This is from chapter one, and it's entitled Mystery House. Back in the 1960s, when I was a kid living in St. Albans, Queens in New York City, there was a huge, forbidding black and gray house that sat on a lovely street not far from my home. The house was located across a set of Long Island Railroad tracks that basically split my neighborhood in half. My side of the tracks was the poor side, tightly clumped, small, exhausted-looking homes, some with neat lawns and manicured flower beds, others like mine in total disarray. The neighborhood was mostly working-class blacks, post office and city transit workers from America's South who had moved to the relative bliss of Queens from the crowded funk of Brooklyn, Harlem, and the Bronx. It was a proud crowd. We had moved up. We were living the American dream. But on the other side of the railroad tracks was the high life, big, sumptuous homes with luscious lawns, long, shiny Cadillacs that eased down smooth, silent streets, a gigantic all-glass church, a beautiful park, a glistening brand new steak and take diner run by the Nation of Islam that stayed open 24 hours a day on weekends. The Nation scared the shit out of everybody in my neighborhood back in those days, by the way. Not even the worst, most desperate junkie would stalk into a stake and take and pull out his heater. He'd be dead before he hit the door. Many of the Nation of Islam Muslims who worked in stake and take were ex-cons, serious, easygoing men in clean white shirts and bow ties who warned you about the ills of pork as they served you all the cheesesteaks you wanted. That place was smooth business. And then there were the celebs who had bought homes nearby. Roy Campanella, Lena Horne, Count Basie, Ella Fitzgerald, Fats Waller, Milt Hinton, all stars, all big time. But none of them lived in the huge forbidding house on Murdoch Avenue with vines creeping onto the spiraled roof and a moat that crossed the small built-in stream with a black Santa Claus illuminated at Christmas and a black awning that swooped down from the front yard in the shape of a wild hairdo. None of them was James Brown. We used to stand outside his house and dream, me and my best friend Billy Smith. Sometimes crowds of us would stand around, kids from my neighborhood, kids from other neighborhoods. A kid from nearby Hollis named Al Sharpton used to stand out there sometimes, but I didn't know him in those days. The rumor was, and this went on for years, that the godfather of soul would slip out of his house at night, walk around the corner to nearby Addisley Park, sit down and talk to the kids and just give out money. Give it out by the 20s and 50s if you promised him that you'd stay in school. We hung out in the park and waited and waited and waited. We waited for months, all summer, all winter. Our promises ready, but he never showed. I knew of no one in my neighborhood who actually met the great man until my sister Dottie, age 11, fell into our house one afternoon, breathless, sweating, and screaming, "Oh, my God! Oh, my God! You won't believe it! Oh, my God! Helen!" Helen was the sister above Dottie in age and Dot's guru in those days. And she came running, and the rest of us gathered around, and it took several minutes for Dottie to compose herself, and finally she blurted out her story. She and her best friend, Shelley Cleveland, had slipped across the railroad tracks to linger outside James Brown's house after school, like all the kids did. Of course, he didn't come out. But that afternoon, Dottie and Shelley decided to do something no kid in my neighborhood, no kid in New York City, no kid in the world that I knew of at that point in my 8-year-old life had ever done or even thought to do. They went up to the front door and knocked. A white maid answered. She said, "What do you want?" Can we speak to Mr. Brown?" Dottie asked. "Wait a minute," the maid said. She disappeared. A few moments later, James Brown himself appeared at the door with two white women, one on each arm, both dressed in 60s wear, complete with beehive hairdos. Dottie and Shelley nearly fainted. The godfather of soul seemed tickled. He greeted them warmly. He asked Dottie, "What's your name?" And she told him, and he said, "Stay in school, Dottie. Don't be no fool." He shook her hand and shook Shelley's hand, and the two girls fled. We listened, breathless, as Dottie recounted it. It seemed unbelievable. Even my mother was impressed. "See that?" she barked. "Listen to James Brown. Stay in school." But who cared about what she said? What was important was that James Brown said it. Dottie's star soared. She had always been a total James Brown fanatic, but in a house of 12 kids where food was scarce and attention scarcer, where ownership of the latest James Brown RPM was like owning the Holy Grail, Dottie morphed from underling to holding a special kind of status, ambassador to famedom, chosen member of the tribe, a button man, a made member of the mob. In other words, a big kid with gold star standing. The shine lasted months. She would stand in our freezing living room on cold winter nights when there was nothing to eat and nowhere to go and no money to go there anyway and play out the scenario. "He's so small," she declared. "He was a little guy." She'd leap up and whip her hair back in James Brown style, thrust out her jaw and holler in a southern accent, "Stay in school, Dottie. Don't be no fool. Ha!" We howled. Visitors, neighbors, even my gruff stepfather and the serious people from church asked her to relive the moment, which she did, giving a blow-by-blow account of how the hardest working man in show business, Mr. Dynamite herself, had come to the door of his house and given it to her straight. "Stay in school, Dottie." The grumpy old church folks listened and nodded stern approval. James Brown was right. "Stay in school, Dottie." I watched all this in grim silence. My crummy sister had beat me to the punch. She had kissed the black stone. She'd met James Brown. My jealousy lasted for years. Every man or woman in this life has a song. And if you're lucky, you can remember it. The song of your wedding, the song of your first love, the song of your childhood. For African Americans, the song of our life, the song of our entire history is embodied in the life and times of James Brown. He is easily one of the most famous African Americans in the world and arguably the most influential African American in music history. His picture hangs on the walls of African homes and huts where people don't even know what he did for a living. His imprint has been felt throughout Western Europe, Asia, the Far East. His dances, his language, his music, his style, his pioneering funk, his manner of speaking are stamped into the American consciousness as deeply as that of any civil rights leader or sports hero, including Muhammad Ali, Michael Jordan, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. He is arguably the most misunderstood and misrepresented African-American figure of the last 300 years, and I would speculate that he is nearly as important and as influential in American social history as, say, Harriet Tubman or Frederick Douglass. When his 2006 funeral procession steered slowly through Harlem, men rushed out of barbershop with shaving cream on their faces. Children stayed home from school. Old people wept openly. The Apollo Theater crowds lined up the streets for five city blocks, thousands of people from 125th Street to 130th Street. Black America from front to back took a knee and bowed. The king of pop himself, Michael Jackson, flew to Augusta for the funeral service, a coronation from a king to a king. Black Americans loved Michael too, but while he was Black America's child, abandoned at times, forsaken, adopted again, in, out, black, white, not sure, there was no question about who James Brown was. James Brown was our soul. He was unquestionably black, unquestionably proud, unquestionably a man. He was real and he was funny. He was the uncle from down south who shows up at your house, gets drunk, takes out his teeth, embarrasses you in front of your friends and grunts, "Stay in school." But you love him and you know he loves you. Well, what happened was as Richard Pryce, I was walking down the street. I don't believe you heard me. I was walking down. No. I got a call from a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy who said that, you know, the James Brown story is available. There's a family member who wants to tell the story, and are you interested? I had recently, and I was in the middle of a very difficult emotional and financial business of divorce, and I needed some money. I had not finished The Good Lord Buried, which later, you know, won the National Book Award and all that. That wasn't done. So I had to do something. So it was either, you know, hit the road with the Count Basie band and, you know, wish for the best if they would have me, which they would not in the shape that I was in, or write this book. So I checked into it. First I turned it down, even though it just didn't seem. I went down there, I met relatives, and I just didn't, you know. Then I changed my mind. Editor said they should get me some good dough for it. So I took it on, and then I walked into, like, you know, a minefield. But I love his work. You know, I loved what he did, and I love what he did technically as a musician, and I love what he represented for the community that I grew up in, and I thought he was important. So I went about the business of finding out who he was. I'd just like to explain to you, like in a technical sense, why. And by the way, remind me to talk about Richard Jones, because James Brown, his whole band, and his great band, from about 1966 to about 1974, were the years that his band was the best band ever, really. These guys rehearsed, like, they would do a gig and they rehearsed 5 hours after the gig because somebody made a mistake or just James Brown wanted to rehearse, or... You couldn't rehearse bands like that now, even if you, no union would allow it and no musician would put up with it. But, and his band was made mostly Southerners. And a lot of his sound, a lot of his originality came from what Pee Wee Ellis and Fred Wesley created, and not James Brown. Pee Wee Ellis is a tenor saxophonist from Rochester. And Fred Wesley is a trombonist from Mobile, Alabama. But James Brown in the early years, when he was really, you know, on fire, the only Northerners in his band were from Philadelphia. There was a string player who's still alive named Richard Jones. He's in his 90s now. Oh, he's here? Where? Oh, Richard, what's he doing here? All right, well, anyway. All right, but he's not really 90. He's really 70. He's really 70. I mean, he's, you know. Richard, stand up and let the people see you. if you buy this book, you'll read a little bit about Richard Jones. That's an added incentive. But James Brown had a string section of five string players. Was it four or five, Richard? Five? Four. All from Philadelphia. They were the only Northerners in the band. Everybody else was from the South. And Richard tells an interesting story. He told about how they were playing the Latin Casino. And, oh, by the way, if you can hear this string section when you hear Live at the Apollo. And James Brown, Richard tells a story where James Brown was, he would say, you know, I want these strings to step, like, you know, the rest of the band. Doom, da, 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 da. And he said to Richard one day, I want the strings to step, you know. And Richard said, but, you know, Richard knew that Mr. Brown didn't know what a cello was. So he said, Mr. Brown, you know, see the guy with the big violin? See, he can't. And James Brown said, oh, it's okay, all right, it's all right. So I'm glad I mentioned that. I'm glad that people got a chance to see Mr. Jones. There is an extremely deep legacy of music here in Philadelphia. You don't need James Brown here to talk about Sam Reed, for example, the great Reed player, Richard Jones, who was a musical director of several big soul groups in Philadelphia. I mean, I suppose we should talk about the Philadelphia Orchestra and its resistance to black players, but I guess we can, you know, have that discussion another time. But when Richard and the string section, James Brown used to carry the string section with him all the time. When they were playing in Latin Casino in New Jersey, which in New Jersey, in this section of the city of the world, and I've had some experience with being hired as a freelance musician in this area, there are certain artists who would come to Philly and they'd say, you know, like Lou Rawls would come in and say, if I look in the pit and I don't see in the hood number of black people, you know, it's not going to work. Sammy Davis as well, Gladys Knight also. Well, James Brown was playing in the 60s at Latin Casino. They didn't have many black musicians out there. And he walked into the room and they had a whole bunch of string players in the front. They were all white. And James Brown walked into the rehearsal and he said, where's Mr. Jones? He said to the contractor, where's Mr. Jones? And the guy said, well, you know, he said, Mr. Brown, we have some of the best string players in the world here. Mr. Brown said, James Brown said, can you sing Goodfoot? And the guy said, no. He said, well, you will be singing unless Mr. Jones. So then he said, Richard said, it was like the Red Sea parted and all four string players came up to the front. And he used to, Richard talked about an interesting, you know, situation like when he went to Europe to try to get German string players to swing. It was like being like the third monkey trying to get on Noah's Ark. I mean, you know. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, come back later. You know, this one's not looking that good. So, but in any case, one of the really unique things about James Brown musically, before I talk about him personally, musically, was that when the transition from, you know, the race music blues of Billy Eckstein translated to Louis Jordan, who really is probably one of the most underrated American musicians of all time, because Louis Jordan was the first one. Louis Jordan had this hard swinging band that dressed clean, and he always had these traded jokes, and that's what James Brown would do on stage. You know, hey, Maceo, come in. You know, there was a whole banter. Even if it wasn't real, it was just for the audience, and his band was tight, and he influenced James Brown greatly. When James Brown started to evolve, his first hit was called Please, Please, Please. And that hit, if you saw the movie, which was about 40% fiction, if you saw that movie, you know, James Brown got out. Let me just very quickly. He was born in Barnwell, South Carolina. He lived there until he was supposedly seven, but I think it was more like 8 or 9. I think he was 4 years older than he told anybody. He ended up moving to Augusta, Georgia, where he lived with his great aunt for several years. And then he was arrested at age 15 or 16 and sent to prison for like 10 or 12 years for stealing parts from a car. He served 3 years and a day. He came out. He ended up in the city of Toccoa, small town of Toccoa. And nobody wanted to be bothered with him because they called him Convict. That was his nickname. And then he met a woman there named Velma Warren, and he married her. And he was married to her for 4 years. Now, the fiction is that he, you know, if you see the movie, he was living in Bobby Bird's basement, and, you know, he was dating Bobby Bird's sister. I don't know about him dating Bobby Bird's sister. I can't speak to that. Maybe he did. But he certainly did not live in Bobby Bird's basement for 4 years. Because, first of all, Bobby Bird was going to North Carolina A&T at that time. And secondly, James Brown was married. He had two kids, and he was a janitor at the Toccoa, all-white Toccoa Elementary School. And in fact, the head of the Toccoa Elementary, Toccoa, she's a principal of the Toccoa High School, told me that when she was about 7 or 8 years old, she and her girlfriend would go in the basement to listen to the piano player down there playing and singing. She said he sounded wonderful. She said we were his only audience. In 1955, while living with his wife in a house that they bought, James Brown wrote, or co-wrote, Please, 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 which became a kind of, you know, it became a hit. And then he fell off the grid. He was a one-hit wonder. And at that time, the flames that were with him began to kind of disintegrate and fall apart. And he spent 2 or 3 years himself just working the Chitlin circuit alone, hiring pickup bands. He picked up a bass player named Bernard Odom. He ended up staying with him for a long time. And during that Chitlin circuit time, he pushed out another hit called Try Me. But only when he really popped was he came out in 1960. He managed to regroup and push through a hit called Out of Sight. Out of Sight was a very interesting piece because Out of Sight went from when it was based on the blues, but the groove was different. The blues is like this: one chord, four chord, five chord. So here's the one chord. One chord, doom, doom, one chord, doom, 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 two, three, four, one. Now you change to the four chord, doom, doom, four chord, doom, doom, back to the one chord, doom, doom, one chord. Now you go to the five chord and get your beer and six chord, down, then to the one chord, to the five, and then one chord. So that's what Out of Sight was, but Out of Sight was in a different groove. Dump, bump, da-da-da, one. Da, 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 one chord, da, na, na. Then you move to the four chord. Then and so that was because the groove was a little different. Out of Sight had a certain kind of pop to it that was relatively new to listeners. And then after Out of Sight happened, James Brown began to reinvent himself, and this reinvention took several years. It culminated when James Brown had his big band with Richard Jones and the Philadelphia String Section. The evolution took 3 or 4 years. And it sort of culminated in 1968 when he put together Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. But a lot had to do with the musicians that he chose to put in his band. Now, if you ever listen to the song Funky Drummer by James Brown, in which he counts off a song and they just start to play, it's just a groove, you'll hear the drums of a guy named Clyde Stubblefield. Now, James Brown hated Clyde. Clyde was a guy from Chattanooga, Tennessee. And he was not formally trained. But what he did was he would play the sound that he heard of the freight trains that rolled past his window every day. And so he changed, Clyde Stubblefield, really, more than anyone in James Brown's group, changed the whole meaning of what R&B drums should sound like. Because, you know, when you hear drums, you hear a guy go doom dat, doom dat dat, doom dat, doom dat dat dat. But what Clyde Stubblefield did was, with his left hand, he would hold the stick really loose, so that when it fell onto the snare drum, it didn't hit. It was so you would hear this boom boom tat 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 boom boom tat 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 boom tat tat. And he didn't do anything else. He just laid like that, and he laid down a super super soulful tight pocket with this boom, and James Brown based a lot of his music around the creativity of Clyde Stubblefield and later Jabbo Starks, who were the two drummers that played with James Brown. The reason why he had two drummers is because he'd wear one out. And in those days, they didn't have, you know, big PA. The guy would get tired, so he'd go to the next guy. They would switch off. The other thing to remember about his band is that Bernard Odom was a mean kind of grim cat from Mobile, Alabama, who created a lot of the great bass lines in James Brown's group. And as he amassed these musicians, the great Pee Wee Ellis, who really actually wrote Say It Loud, I'm Black. I'm James Brown with the lyrics, but Pee Wee Ellis wrote Say It Loud. He wrote Cold Sweat, you know, and Cold Sweat he really got from Miles Davis, because Pee Wee Ellis was a jazz musician, and he later went on to a very, very fantastic jazz career. And if you ever hear Miles Davis's song, So What? If you hear Cold Sweat, it's the same key, same modality and everything. So James Brown was wise enough to get these superbly gifted musicians together, some of whom were technically excellent, like Richard Jones and the Philadelphia musicians who could read really well and who understood jazz and harmony, and others, like he had a couple of trumpet players who could barely read music. But he had music directors like Fred Wesley, who was a trombonist out of Mobile, and Pee Wee Ellis to help him shape and to make his grunts into music. So when he came, by the time, 1968 came around, he had evolved from going from the one chord, doom, 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 to the going from the one to the four to just simply staying on the one. And then sometimes he would go to the four just for two or three bars and then come back to the one. And what he did was, with the help of Clyde and Jabbo and his fantastic rhythm guitarist, Jimmy Nolan, and Harlan Cheese. What was Cheese's last name? Country, yeah. What was his real, Country Kellum. Right. I should also mention that when you talk about counterpoint, like if you pull out a third violin part of a Bach piece, it makes perfect sense. If you go to James Brown's early work, from like 1964 to 1974, and you pull out the guitar parts created by Jimmy Nolan, they make perfect sense. Because James Brown's band was a mixture of many things. It was an amalgam of rhythmically implemented horn, guitar, bass, and drum parts that were woven together to create what the musicians called a washing machine thing. And so he put all this together, and part of his gift was that he had the ability to get musicians who could translate his grunts and his lyrics into songs that made sense. And also, finally, technically, one of the things that he came up with was that every eighth, at the ninth beat, in other words, every two bars, he would have a big hit on the downbeat. So he'd go like Cold Sweat is like, doom, da, na, doom, doom, da, doom, da, na, doom, doom, boom, da, na, doom, doom, da, doom, da, na, doom, doom, da, boom. And that hit on the one was one of his innovations. But he did not do that alone. He did that because when he auditioned Clyde Stubblefield against five other drummers, he saw something in that little kid from Tennessee that he knew he had to have. And personally, he didn't like Clyde Stubblefield because Clyde was stubborn and, he just didn't like Clyde because Clyde was a quiet country boy and wouldn't do everything James Brown said. But he loved Clyde, but he hated Clyde. But he could dance to Clyde. And so Clyde stayed in the band. There are lots of musicians, by the way. There are probably about 200 musicians that passed through James Brown's band. His greatest band was the band I told you about, the band that was about from 1964 to 74 that had the string players. For example, Bernard Pretty Purdy has made quite a living being an ex drummer of James Brown. But Bernard Pretty Purdy actually really was never a road member of James Brown's band. He played with them in the studio. But the guy who created James Brown's sound was Clyde Stubblefield and Jabbo Starks. And there are others who say, I play with, there are many guitar players who used to play guitar with James Brown, and I'm sure some of them are very good musicians. But Jimmy Nolan is the guy who created those guitar licks that are copied and sampled in keyboards all over the place. There's not a piece of American music now that you hear that does not have a little bit of James Brown in it. But when you say James Brown, you have to remember you're saying Clyde Stubblefield, you're saying Pee Wee Ellis, Maceo Parker, Fred Wesley, St. Clair Pinckney, Richard Jones, Jabbo Starks, and so forth. In any case, that was the musical side. On the personal side, James Brown was an eccentric. And he was seen in society as a kind of like weirdo. I mean, especially toward the end of his life, he was in jail, he had this hairdo, he was a great dancer, but he was just a weird cat. But I spent almost 4 years on this book. And by the time I was done, I actually liked and respected James Brown even more than when I first started. And part of the reason is that he felt deeply misunderstood. He lived in a world where, firstly, he grew up very poor, but a lot of people grew up very poor. I mean, some of you grew up very poor, Shall I name you? No, I will not. But stand up if you know. But don't you hate it when you go to church and the minister says, shake hands with the person next to you and tell them, why do I want to shake their hand? I mean, I didn't come here to shake their hand. Let's get the music started. Huh? Shake some guy's hand, what? If I feel out afterwards or whatever. But anyway, Anyway, why did I get into it? You know, one of the problems when you're doing a book like this, when it's about injustice, that you're trying so hard to get your innocence back because you've seen so much that was wrong. So much went wrong with James Brown's life. Nobody feels sorry. You know, the great overbook graduate, Wilt Chamberlain, used to say, nobody feels sorry for Goliath. But people thought that James Brown was this rich guy who, you know, he treated his band bad, and he was on drugs, he had all these girlfriends, he had outside kids. All that's true. But so does, you know, I'm sure some of these rock and roll stars of his generation have had outside kids. Don't even get started. I mean, he's not the only one who's lived that kind of life. But the flip side of it is this guy was very generous to his community. First of all, James Brown left his entire estate, which was worth conservatively worth about $100 million. He left every penny to educate poor white and black children in South Carolina and Georgia. Everything, his likeness, his music, his publishing, everything. That was 10 years ago, Christmas. In 10 years, not a single dime has reached a single child. Because his children, some of his claimed children, and his wife, the last wife, and they got involved, and it's been 4,000 pages of testimony, 48 lawsuits, 90 attorneys, most of whom never knew James Brown. In fact, I just heard it the other day about the new attorney they brought on, that they're paying this guy $60,000 a month, I'm sorry. I mean, what they do is they just create lawsuits and they just build his estate. This is the state of South Carolina. The attorney general rewrote his will. He spent $20,000 putting together an airtight will. And to this day, not a single kid has been educated. And that's because some of his children who are less than, I mean, they call this greed in Philly. I don't know what they call it in South Carolina. They probably call it justice, but we call it just being a greedy you know what. Some of his children, his last wife, if she was his wife, because she was actually married before, she married James Brown, and then, you know, but they just ruled she wasn't. But we call that bigamy up here in Philly. I don't know what they call that in South Carolina. And then the lawyers and judges got involved, and basically what they do is until about 4 or 5 years ago, there was only one law school in South Carolina, and that was the University of South Carolina. So all these lawyers know each other. And so they just milk the cow. They send it to him, they send it to them. And anyone who gets in their way, they just run them over. The only one who has followed James Brown's story consistently is a 63-year-old white woman named Sue Summer, who writes for a small paper in Newberry, South Carolina. And they have tried their best to make this woman's life miserable. Threatened to throw her in jail, freedom of information. I mean, they've subpoenaed her twice. I mean, this is a grandmother who gets subpoenas delivered. She got a subpoena delivered to her front door while she was putting her granddaughter to bed. South Carolina is really, it feels like it's about 50 years behind the rest of America. And so, the current attorney general there is the son. Remember the guy who said when Obama said, you know, was talking to the, delivering to, and the guy who said, you lie, the congressman? He was from South Carolina. The current attorney general of South Carolina is his son, who's now under some kind of investigation for this, that. James Brown predicted to his manager, Charles Bobbitt, he said, when I die, it's going to be a big mess. And it has been just that. And that's another example of how his life has become a kind of metaphor for how we treat each other, how lawyers run this country. James Brown was born in Barnwell, South Carolina, but his family is actually from a place called Ellenton, South Carolina. And this is something that nobody found out except for yours truly, only because I was too stupid to know that I was walking into something that was like deeper than I suspected. In Ellenton, South Carolina, in 1951, James Brown came from an extended family of sharecroppers. And in 1951, in the town of Ellenton, Dunbar, and several other towns, they began to notice some strange activity. These strangers were driving up with trucks and putting down markers and so on and so forth, and they didn't know what was going on. And then around Thanksgiving, there was a big meeting in town, and they were told, you all have to move, that we're going to build a nuclear bomb-making plant here. We need to keep America safe, and everybody has to move. They moved six towns. They took 361 square miles of territory, DuPont Company, General Electric, and U.S. government, took thousands of people and moved them all. They moved churches, stores, dogs, farms, cats, everything. Everything had to move. Now, most of the people who were dislocated were now the working class white farmers and the working poor, if they had homes, their homes were put on back of trucks and moved, or the government would buy you a new home, you know, with the same value. But the sharecroppers, the majority of the ones who were displaced were black sharecroppers who had no homes. So they were just scattered. They were just scattered to the wind. And James Brown was part of that lost tribe. And today, the Savannah River nuclear site is still there. They still make nuclear bombs. It's a bomb-making facility, essentially. It processes uranium for nuclear bombs. And so that's another metaphor in terms of to show how his life has just been. And when he died, when he became an old man, he only lived in New York for 10 years. He moved back to South Carolina. He bought a house, and from the front door of his house, he could see the two towers that rise up from the Savannah River nuclear site. They rise way up in the sky. And in his old age, he would tell Charles Bobbitt, his manager, he'd say, "See that, Mr. Bobby? See them towers? See how they're blinking?" He said, "That's the government. That's the government listening. They can hear me. They can hear me through my teeth. They're listening through my teeth." He was so paranoid about the government because, as a boy, and his father taught him this as well, you don't have to worry about the government taking back what they want. They can just walk in your house and hang their hat on the rack, no matter what color you are. If they want to take it, they're going to take it. And so he had a great fear of the government. And he was clean to the IRS, to the walls by the IRS twice. It took 30 cars, everything. So he had a penchant for hiding money. He hid money everywhere. He dug holes and just buried money everywhere. You might go home right now, look in your backyard. I think I'm going to go home with Richard. Maybe he had a little something. You know, he buried money. Are we about halfway? All right. So I'm gonna open. Finally, what the other thing this book does? It visits a lot of people that knew James Brown. Reverend Sharpton spent 15 years with James Brown, and when you see Reverend Sharpton talk, you see James Brown. This book is I visited his first wife, and she's never done an interview, and he had a wonderful relationship with his first wife. And I talk about the loss of his son Teddy, which really broke his heart. And I talk about how he went to Zaire and he wouldn't take the Mobutu's diamonds; he just wanted to go home. He was, you know, he had a saying. This book, "Kill 'Em and Leave," comes from what he used to tell Reverend Sharpton. He said, "Kill 'Em and Leave." Right? He, you know, the band would start playing, you know, boom, tack, and the crowd, ah, ah, and he knew exactly when it was time to come out. And then when he came out, he would just kill him. And then he, when he was done, he would leave. But he'd get under the hairdryer first and get his hair permed and straightened out. Because Southern people, and James Brown was more of a Southerner than he was a black man, really. Southern people believe in the kind of dignity and pride and proper, looking proper, being proper. You could be broke, but you got to be proper. And you have to be, you show honor and dignity. And that's why he's so misunderstood, I think, in American society, in part because he was a child of the South. And when he died, his management team were all Southerners, two white guys and a black guy. And the black guy died. The two white guys, they were both sued. They were financially pretty much destroyed because of the lawsuits. And one of his accountants went to jail. A good old boy Republican, 68 years old, went to jail for nothing, really. And, you know, he was the perfect villain because he looked like, you know, this is the guy who stole James Brown's money. These people didn't understand that if James Brown trusted you, he knew what he was doing. So I wrote this book in part to hope that, you know, in the hopes that God will free up what James Brown wanted, which is to, you know, free up his estate so that these children can get an education. He wanted to atone for the wrong he did in his life. And I don't know many stars at his level who have tried to do that. He had a really good heart, and he really did love poor people of all colors. He was a conflicted man, but, you know, so are we. But in any case, I'm going to open the floor to questions because, you know, I'm sure you have them. And so what you have to do is if you have a question, raise your hand, and then the microphone will come to you. Here's the first one. Yes?
Very much, and I just want to say you are the truth. And I really appreciate what you've done. I've always liked James Brown, and I really appreciate what you've said. I read about a page and a half review from the New York Times about your book, and that, you know, kind of incited me to want to get the book and to read it and to come here tonight. But finally, what I'd like to know is, could you have seen yourself in the James Brown Band as a musician yourself? And what you gonna do now?
Okay. Well, you know, a few years ago, before Grover Washington died, we were in the studio working, and he recorded one of my songs. He recorded a couple of my songs, but this song he recorded, I played electric piano. I'm a saxophonist, but I played electric piano, and Ramsey Lewis played acoustic piano. And I was struggling because I was so nervous, you know. I mean, these, you know, Ramsey Lewis, and I'm not even a piano player. I mean, I can play my, you know, I did it. But, you know, when we were in the studio talking, and I said, man, Grover, I just need to stick with saxophone. And we started talking about music and stuff, and I said to him, you ever play with James Brown? And he said, you kidding? He said, I wasn't funky enough. If Grover wasn't funky enough, surely I am not funky enough. And I should say, you know, I should say that one of the real ironies about living in Philadelphia is that you have these great musicians here. When next time you listen to, you know, Kenny G or Dave Koz or any of these free jazz guys, just remember, when you listen to rap music, you're hearing a little bit of Grover Washington too. Because Grover Washington was the first one that came up with this boom, 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 back in the day when I was a teen, before I had a beeper and before I had a pager. That was the beat to Mr. Magic. Boom, 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 boom. And that was Grover Washington. And the whole business of smooth jazz really emanated in great part from Grover Washington. So, I mean, he never got credit for that. And he was a young man when he died. He was only 58. He was a great musician. He had a great band. All Philadelphia players. He had some killing guys in his band. But no, the dream would have been to play in James Brown's band, but I just ain't funky enough.
So it was probably 1966, and I saw James Brown on stage in Atlantic City do his cape dance. And I was wondering if you could talk about the origin of that cape dance and where it came from and where it went.
Oh, you mean the whole thing with him taking the cape off and putting it on?
Yeah.
I mean, he said there was some gorgeous George the Wrestler. I'm not really sure. I mean, that's what James Brown said. Now, some of the fiction about James Brown, there's a lot of it. Some of it he created himself because he figured you just tell white folks what they want to hear. It doesn't matter. I mean, they just want to hear you sing and dance. They don't know nothing about you. They ain't never going to care no way. So just tell them. I mean, in his book, he says, you know, he describes himself as part Asian Afro. You know, I mean, I don't know. And he was related to Geronimo, you know. I think the Geronimo part was there was a tax dodge because, you know, you knew that Indians and Native Americans didn't pay taxes. Really. At one point he said, I don't have to pay taxes because Hubert Humphrey said I'm a national treasure. So, you know. But the United House of Prayer, which is depicted horribly in this movie, Get On Up, is one of the most sophisticated and compelling pieces of African-American life. The Pentecostal or apolistic church, the music that's played at the United House of Prayer is unlike anything I have ever seen. The music never stops. And they had, when I was there, they had like 20 horn players, and these guys could play. And they had, you know, drums, and they play like a blend of what sounded like New Orleans jazz and gospel music. Never heard anything like it ever, and I've heard a lot of music. And that's the music he listened to when he was a young boy. And I talk about that when he met his best friend, Leon Austin, who he knew all his life. Leon Austin lived three doors away from the United House of Prayer. And in those days, Daddy Grace, the older black members of this audience remember Daddy Grace or know of him, because he was the southern version of Father Divine, who was up here in North Philly. Daddy Grace was a revered, you know, the thing was, Daddy Grace was supposedly a prophet. Like, he was considered a prophet. And I visited United House of Prayer, and I write about that in the book, but that's where James Brown got a lot of his church stuff from. In addition to the fact that he went to church in Ellenton, South Carolina, and even at the end of his life, he rebuilt his family's church in Elko, South Carolina. He rebuilt the church that his great aunt attended. And he joined the choir, and he sang in the choir there occasionally. He was actually a very religious man. When I say very religious, James Brown rarely cursed. When they trotted that script out to Charles Bobbitt for Get On Up, and they showed it to Charles Bobbitt, Charles Bobbitt gave it back to the director and said, first of all, this thing is full of motherfucker. And he said, James Brown never talked like that. He said, I've known him for 41 years. I've heard him curse maybe three times. He just didn't curse. He wasn't that kind. He was a proper man. So that movie was just a terrible depiction. I mean, I'm a little bit, at my age, I'm starting to like say stuff that really isn't politically right. But I'm a little bit tired of Hollywood like dipping into black American life and just creating these stereotypical characters that have no basis in reality. Can we see some black women who are like shy, who are like resistant, who like science maybe, who have hobbies instead of just big black mamas who say, you know, you special boy, you gonna go far. I mean, I'm done with the Maya Angelou depiction of African American. I'm just finished with it. You know, I'm no longer interested in seeing that because you're teaching the culture to the children. You're teaching the wrong kind of culture. So that movie was just, I mean, the whole thing, him driving through two police cars in Georgia? No, he didn't. No, sir.
Would you talk a little bit about why Reverend Sharpton or the NAACP or other African-American organizations have not been able to bring justice to his estate?
That's a good question. I don't know. I asked that of Reverend Sharpton, and he said, well, I don't want to get into it with Deanna and them, Deanna being James Brown's daughter who's kind of heading the show. And I think he felt like he feels, I mean, I can't speak for Al Sharpton, but I think his cooperation with this book is kind of his tacit approval of he'd like to see this thing get moving. But I mean, he's a politician, and I'm a writer, and you know, I don't know Sharpton that well. I mean, I covered the Michael Jackson Victory Tour for 6 months, 1984, and Sharpton was on that tour. And I never really spoke to him very much because, I was a reporter. My job was to be a reporter. The Jacksons hated me, actually. They thought I was like Uncle Tom, because they had never seen a black writer from People magazine before. And they hated the magazine, you know. It was months before they even spoke to me. So, but after a while, there was some respect. And, you know, there was stuff that went on that tour that I never wrote about because I just felt it was Michael's personal business. And I liked him a lot. And I really felt that, you know, this whole business of child molestation, I felt it was just all a bunch of made-up stuff. But I never publicly spoke about it because it's just, you know, I didn't want to get into that kind of silliness. But you ask a legitimate question. You know, if Reverend Sharpton were to stand on the state, in the front state of the, you know, state house, in front steps of the state house, in courthouse, in Aiken County, South Carolina, and say, you know, my father, as he refers to James, if my father wants these kids educated, would the outcome be different? Probably. But personally, I'm never going to step foot in South Carolina again because I'm scared I might get arrested. I mean, the people who are putting this, look, it's easy to talk about this here in Philly, but this morning, before I did the radio show with Marty Moscone, I did a radio program with a reporter from the Georgia public radio station. And her reaction to my words in this book were completely different. She was completely funky. She had, you know, she knew James Brown's daughter, and she had clips of the daughter saying, my father was very poor, and he wanted the children to have things, and, you know, he couldn't even have a coat, so he would give his coat to... I said to her, we already know that. Let's talk about this will, and talk about this, you know, this trust that he, this foundation, let's talk about that. And so she said, well, his daughter said the foundation is working, and you're saying it's not, so what do you think about that? I said to her, I think it's journalism 101 for you to pick up the phone and call South Carolina and find out, because I know I'm right. You know, but see, you know, his daughter, she's a media savvy, and she goes around, you know, and she gets little donations for this James Brown School of Funk or School of Music Pupils Academy or something. And white folks don't care, so, you know, they just think she's doing something. I mean, come on. The guy left $100 million to educate poor people and has been kicked around for 10 years. And, you know, people, you know what happens? The truth travels like this in a straight line. Now, when you lie, you got to go all around this. You got to remember the lie, and you got to fix it up later. And that's really what this is about. I mean, I'm sure his daughter has set up some sort of foundation, you know. So if she set it up, why don't she just name it after herself? Because her father already got one. So, my point is that, yes, it would be nice if the NAACP got involved. But that group is under fire. I mean, they have a lot to... First of all, they probably don't even know. And secondly, you know, I don't know that they're that strong in South Carolina because I'm not going back there. You know, they need some sort of federal intervention in something like this because they're making up the rules as they go along. Look, there was a time when a story that smelled this bad, people kicking around $100 million and kicking around the sole reporter who's looking after it, it would waft up here to Philadelphia. And then you get the Inquirer, the old Inquirer, and those, you could throw a rock across that newsroom and hit five of the baddest reporters you ever saw in your life. And they would go down there and they would kick the door in, and then the networks would come in and finish the job, and the rats would scurry. But newspapers are not what they once were. And you and I, well, I don't own a TV, but somebody's watching TV and wasting time on Donald Trump and all this other nonsense. When there's real news that's happening, and when newspapers are going, this is a reason why you have to read books and force and pay for your news so you can get real reporters to go to places like South Carolina and free up this kind of money that needs to be freed for these kids. Otherwise, you have what you have now, which is you have these giant law firms fighting against this one reporter, and then they just feed a little tidbit to some blogger or some half-journalist wannabe who they put it on the internet, and then someone believes it's fact. That put David Cannon, a 68-year-old white man, in jail for, as far as I'm concerned, my personal opinion, for nothing. I mean, the guy did everything James Brown told him what to do. I mean, so legitimate question? I don't know what the answer is going to be.
We go way back, Third World Dorm, Oberlin College. And I remember your freshman year. You had a wonderful personality. And you got along with everybody. And I just want to, I'm proud to see that you've come full circle. And I wish you the very best with all of your creative works. And it's been a long time, James. Yow.
Oh, wow. Yow, you got kind of big. Yeah, wow. Yeah, it's good to see you. Yow, I think Yow was one of those who participated in the, when we had that big protest against, trying to get the school to divest funds in Nelson Mandela's. Yeah, we had this big, big fight at Oberlin. We were trying to get the school to divest its funds in companies doing business. And you know what? There was a big split in the black community at Oberlin because some of the black students refused to participate because white students started it. But Yao was among those who said, who went on strike. Cause I went on strike as well. I mean, when we went on strike, it's because we didn't work. That meant we didn't go. Yao had to work. Yeah, but we also had to go on strike, because I went on strike. I remember that because I know how my money works. But anyway, I think it's time for us to go. What I'd like to close with, go ahead, what? Oh, well, thank you very much. Well, thank you. Well, I'm delighted to see you here. You know, my mother died in 2010, and she was 88. She lived a good life. She would have been 94, April 1st. But, you know, 88 is a long time. And I was blessed to have her for that long. And I still continue her work. I still work at the church that she founded in Brooklyn. I run a music program there with kids from the projects. I do it twice a week. Now I got my son doing it. And you just do what you can do, you know. You do what you can do, and I'm just thrilled and honored that you came out tonight, and thank you very much. Remember James Brown, and remember what he tried to do. He really wanted people to live well. He wanted people to get along, and he meant it, and he proved it over the course of his life and after his life. So keep that in mind, and once again, thanks for coming out.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.